Welcome once again, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan, and with me, as always, my two partners in crime, there's Danny King, a writer for The Film Stage.
Hey, happy December.
Woo! Please don't remind me it's December. That's actually pretty depressing. The year's gone by way too quick. Here with his thoughts on December also, Nick Newman, associate editor for The Film Stage.
It's so depressing to realize that 2012 is practically over, and I feel like this year was kind of a wash. So,
you mean like personally, collectively, politically,
just cinematically? Personally and collectively. So enjoy your podcast.
Hopefully we've been the one bright spot in what has otherwise been the long gray winter that was 2012.
Oh, 2012 wasn't really a bad year. It was an interesting year, I'll say that much. But... you know, it's coming to an end, and I'm thinking, was that really it? I don't know. It just feels, it kind of feels like when I'm on my deathbed, I can think back to 2012 and go, well, there are certainly things I'll think about, but I don't know.
All right, what's going on here?
I almost want to investigate this more, because you really seem to have put a lot of thought into 2012.
Sure. This feels, I don't know, it feels like a sort of a 2005 for me.
Okay. I had a really weird and interesting and awesome 2005, so I guess I can't relate to that.
Yeah, no, my 2005 was good, but I look back on it and I think, did I really accomplish anything?
That was my first year in college, so I did a lot. There was a lot accomplished. Huge seismic life shifts. Anyway, that's not what this podcast is about. What this podcast is about is reviewing new releases currently in theaters. Today we'll be talking about Killing Them Softly, the newest film by Andrew Dominik, who had previously directed The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, as well as Chopper, and that stars Brad Pitt and Richard Jenkins, among many others. Before we get into that, we will be doing our movie discussion topic. Today we'll be talking about directors who have wide gaps in their filmography between projects, and why we think that is, and how it affects our judgment of their films, and thoughts on them in general. After all that is done, and we've done our review, we'll be giving you our top selections for what's coming out in the week ahead on Blu-ray and in theaters, and then we'll be giving you a random selection of something that we watched on our own this week. If anyone would like to subscribe to us, you can do that on iTunes. You should also comment and rate us, because that's important for some reason I'm still not quite clear on. And if you ever want to get in touch with us, you can get in touch at podcast@thefilmstage.com. And of course, you can also follow us on Twitter. We'll tell you where we can be found at the end of the episode. So, gentlemen, let's get right to it now that we're done vaguely dissecting 2012 as a year. And let's talk about some directors who have gaps in their filmography. This is inspired, of course, because Andrew Dominik's last film, The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, came out in 2007. And his follow-up took 5 years to come to theaters. So... This isn't nearly as rare as you'd think it would be. Rian Johnson, whose Looper came out, he released The Brothers Bloom in 2008. Darren Aronofsky had a massive 6-year gap between Requiem for a Dream and The Fountain. And Terrence Malick might take the cake because he had 20 years between Days of Heaven and The Thin Red Line. So, Nick, why don't you start us off on your thoughts with this?
What would you like me to say? What do you want to hear?
What do I want to hear?
What do you want me to say?
I'd like to hear, in song version, your thoughts on why you think certain directors take this time. Is it primarily motivated by the success of their previous work? Is it motivated by their creativity getting in the way of easier projects, selectiveness on their part? Mm-hmm. And when you see a gap like this forming, does it make you... like nervous about the trajectory of their career and their creativity at all? Or do you think that it's a good thing that they're kind of storing up this creative energy and then unleashing it in bursts over long periods of time?
Yeah, no, I'm never concerned about that. I always am. I mean, it's difficult for someone who is a fan of a current director when you have to wait. If you look at someone like Kubrick, for example, who took several years between his movies. I mean, there's 12 years between Full Metal Jacket and Eyes Wide Shut. if you look at it from that perspective, it's not bad because you can just pop in one Blu-ray after the other and it's no problem. But if you're talking about someone today like Paul Thomas Anderson, who, you know, of course, many people are fond of comparing to the late Stanley, yeah, it can be frustrating. I mean, I remember, I guess it was about 2 years ago now when the Masters funding fell apart and it looked like maybe he would never get to make it. And people started to ask, well, how long is it going to be until he makes another movie? And that's always problematic because you want it to come and you're just hoping and hoping and hoping and hoping it's going to happen. And when it doesn't, it creates frustration. But I do agree that that tends to give them time to build up something more. And when they finally do make something, it has more power to it, I find. Maybe it's because partially you appreciate it more. Excuse me, knowing that this is not something you're going to get so often, but it also feels like they have time to assimilate their creative powers towards something.
Excellent. Not a lot of singing in that response, but I'll let that slide because it was otherwise really good. Danny, what about yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree that with a lot of the names Nick just mentioned and that you mentioned earlier, taking long times between films often does have a positive impact artistically and in that sense. But it does, it also has a commercial danger. I know a recent example would be Leos Carax, who hasn't made a feature since 1999's Polar X, and he came back this year with Holy Motors, which pretty much everyone who has seen it loves it, but it sort of came and went theatrically, and it hasn't made a lot of money. Even in a place like New York, where you'd think that Leos Carax fans would be lining up for his newest film in a decade, and over a decade. So I think when you take a long time like that, you sort of risk, whether or not you make a good film, you sort of risk how much cultural impact what you're making can have. I also think that this could be found in Terrence Malick. Like, if you look at his first two movies, Badlands and Days of Heaven, and you think of some of the people who are in those movies, if he sort of kept along that track, he could have very easily become a name of like Kubrick stature commercially, just in terms of his reputation. But when he takes 20 years off to make a movie and then comes back with The Thin Red Line, people just don't know, they don't remember, and he kind of loses some of the momentum he had. So I think that's kind of the danger in the way I see it. And from what I've seen, Killing Them Softly hasn't been exactly killing it this weekend either.
No, it made about $7 million.
Yeah.
That was a good pithy headline, by the way. Killing Them Softly hasn't been killing it.
Yeah. Okay. I totally premeditated that.
All right, excellent. Yeah, I definitely agree with everything we've said, especially, I mean, in terms of kind of losing your cultural cachet. Specifically with Terrence Malick, I mean, you know, Badlands, Days of Heaven, and like you said, he could have continued to draw people in like that and get this really big, I don't want to say cachet again, he could have had a big name, a big draw to his name, a big following, and then he comes back and does The Thin Red Line, has a lot of people in it, you know, gets some attention, got people talking, but then I was looking at this, and even between The Thin Red Line and The New World was 7 years. New World came out in 2005, and then Tree of Life was another 6 years. And so, I mean, I obviously was still following him, and the gap really did make me appreciate more and more everything that he was doing, and it was getting me interested in him. But I am the type of person who follows directors that they like. I was there with Darren Aronofsky every step of the way and trying to get The Fountain made. Unfortunately,
you were helping out.
Yeah, I was. You know, I was sending my good vibes, my positive psychic energies. I was definitely working the secret in that.
Brad, don't drop out.
Don't do it, Brad. It's kind of weird how Brad Pitt recently has become kind of an indie like advocate. You know, he's doing a lot of really small films or films that are not really commercially viable, and yet he was almost the reason that The Fountain died. So I'm conflicted about him, but since I still got The Fountain, I think I can forgive him. That was a weird sidetrack. But yeah, I mean, for people like that and Rian Johnson, like people like me, you're gonna keep up, you're gonna keep looking into it, and you're not gonna lose us. But in general, I mean, Rian Johnson just made Looper, and I think that did very well. And I know a lot of people who liked it, people who don't really follow directors. And so I'm just kind of hoping that he doesn't have another gap like he did between, you know, the Brothers Bloom and Looper. That was 5 years, and I don't think that, you know, his cachet will keep up. But right now,
it was 3 years
between the Brothers Bloom and Looper.
It was 3 years, 2009 to 2012.
Okay. Oh, I said five, didn't I?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, I meant four because Brothers Bloom here is marked down as coming as 2008.
Well, that's because it premiered at Toronto, but it didn't actually open theatrically until 2009.
Okay. Well, even when it did, it wasn't. Anyway, Brothers Bloom, I'm sure. I actually had a friend who went and saw a screening of, I think it was Brick that was happening, and Rian Johnson was in attendance, and people were asked not to talk about the Brothers Bloom because of how poorly it had done.
Mm.
But my friend had actually dressed up as Diamond Dog from that movie to go see this. And yeah, so he couldn't really get away with not talking about the Brothers Bloom.
Did he just think that your friend had one eye and walked with a cane?
Yeah, he definitely did. No, he didn't. apparently my friend was actually then, like, talked to him afterwards and offered a PA job on Looper, and he couldn't work it into his schedule.
Ah.
I would have killed someone to be able to do that. But anyway, off topic. Yeah, in general, though, I mean, something like Killing Them Softly, for me, I feel like a lot of the holdup in getting this made probably had something to do with the assassination of Jesse James, and its, not failure, because I really love that movie, but its lack of draw in the popular culture, which I'm sure...
Well, it didn't make any money, which is only, that's, you know, and it didn't get any awards either, so it's perceived as a total failure from Hollywood.
Right. Yeah. And I know that the Brothers Bloom probably had the same effect on the making of Looper. It's just one of those things. It's like, and that almost makes me want it more because I loved those two films, The Assassination and Brothers Bloom. I want to see these directors do it again. I want to see what they come up with next. And I, you know, it's kind of a rooting for the underdog thing. I really want these guys to keep making films. Luckily, I don't think it's going to be a problem for Terrence Malick anytime soon because this guy's on fire.
Wait, which I'm a little worried about, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, I'm concerned. I'm concerned that, like, his big, ambitious projects are gone, and, like, now it's going to be smaller, like, short stories. You know?
It's not so much that. It's actually more that To the Wonder didn't get a great reception when it played at festivals.
His film's really gotten, like, a...
Yeah, but, I mean, even people I know who are huge Terrence Malick fans saw it, and they said it was... I mean, I know one... Actually, Jordan Hoffman, who was a guest on the show... is a huge Malick fan. I remember he said after he saw it, it's the one Malick movie he doesn't like. So I don't know. We'll see.
That's tough. When that's coming out, April?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we might have to have him on the show to talk about it then.
Terrence Malick? Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, definitely.
I want to address a point that Danny made about how this can hurt their this can hurt their commercial prospects. But I was thinking to myself, is Leos Carax someone who really worries about that? And how many people actually know who he is outside of those of our sorts, if you think about it? I mean, you don't think... I think that Paul Thomas Anderson actually has a pretty good exposure. He was on The Daily Show, for instance, for God's sake, when The Master came out, and he was on CBS Morning News, and he was talked about in Time Magazine and other big publications. So I don't know. I think I disagree with your point that it can hurt them.
Well, I was trying... I definitely agree with you that he's not making that movie thinking he's going to, like, you know, get 2,000 theaters or whatever. I just think that even within, like, cinephile circles, like, it's so surprising to me that that movie went to Cannes, made a smash, and came away empty-handed. And then it came here to New York, and it only played, like, it played for a very short amount of time, and it didn't even make that much. And it just feels like if a guy like that's coming back with a movie after over a decade, especially at a place like Cannes, like, they would be almost waiting to just give him an award or something. It's just kind of strange. But, I mean, I agree with you that he's not probably sitting at home wondering, like, why his movie didn't make a lot of money.
Yeah. he was looking at Transformers numbers on that one.
I guess I just feel like most people who wanted to see Holy Motors in New York City ended up seeing it, honestly.
My thing then, though, is even with critical reception like that, I mean, sometimes it works in your favor, like if you're a lost master who's coming back to the craft. But also, you know, there can be that, you know, the wunderkind who doesn't ever follow up type of thing. You know, people just get this idea that maybe you only had that one good film and then they're going to look at your new one
Well, like
through that lens.
Like David Gordon Green, sort of.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that the reception to Killing Them Softly reflects that a lot, because people who don't like it tend to cite the assassination of Jesse James as to why they're so disappointed. Yeah. Not just because they love that movie, but because it came out in 2007. So it's been a long wait. And because this is... I think that if he had made one or two films in between those two, the reception wouldn't be that different. But I think there would be a shade of difference, because people would then look at this movie and they wouldn't think to themselves, well, really, this is what he's following up Jesse James with? Because this is a smaller movie. It's a much different movie. It has much more modest ambitions, I would say, even though the message of it is sort of big. And that I don't know. I think that when you look at a movie of this sort, which doesn't come around that often because it's, you know, it doesn't come around that often because it's from a director who doesn't make movies that often, it's really important to look at the reception and consider how people would react if he was someone who made movies at a greater pace.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true, because when you look at the assassination of Jesse James and you see its scope and its artistry and all that, and then you wait 5 years for him to bring out his next film, and then it is this small and this kind of intimate and such a shift from the last one he made, you're kind of left with a, this is what I waited 5 years for after that crazy awesome experience we had the last time. So I think even if just the wait had been shorter, I don't even know that he needed to have another film between them. This to me felt kind of like a catching your breath and coming back movie. And yeah, it's just kind of weird that it took 5 years for it to come out.
That's the thing, is that I guess people want something more than catching your breath. So
yeah,
but he's got a Marilyn Monroe movie that's going to shoot next year with Naomi Watts. So,
interesting. Yeah. Though after my year with Marilyn, I really don't know what else to say about Marilyn Monroe. I feel like everything has been said.
She said that this is like a fairy tale about a girl who gets lost in the woods of Hollywood.
Huh.
That was a quote. Yeah, it's going to star Naomi Watts, blonde.
That sounds good. And I was totally joking about my year with Marilyn, by the way.
It's called My Week.
My Week.
One fifty-second
of the amount there.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that all six people who saw that movie are really going to give me hell for getting it wrong.
Hey, Danny liked that movie. Be nice.
All right.
Brian, you want to go, bro?
Did you just call me out, bro? All right.
No. Off the air.
I will drive up to New York and beat the shit out of you. I won't do that. Gas is too expensive. I can't afford to do that. Anyway, yes. So since we're already talking about Killing Them Softly, this is probably a good time to move into discussing that film.
Yeah, you gave your political commentary about as subtle as anything in the movie, so let's go.
What was my political commentary? Beating the crap out of Danny?
Gas is too expensive, so it's like, it's like you're in the movie.
No, okay. Being in this movie would be if I randomly turned on some like talk radio and then just let it play over this podcast for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Apropos of nothing. Anyway, Killing Them Softly, directed by Andrew Dominik, starring Brad Pitt, Richard Jenkins, James Gandolfini, and Ray Liotta amongst...
Scoot McNairy.
Scoot McNairy. Love that guy's name. So happy we get to say Scoot McNairy again. Because he was in Argo. And we all really loved saying Scoot McNairy. So yes, starring Scoot McNairy as well.
All right, you ready to do this? Is that what you got, dishwashing gloves? We're gonna look like a bunch of amateurs. Guess this.
A sawn-off shotgun. It's what you asked me to get you.
It's gonna kill everybody in the room.
Mark Trackman's game was hit a couple of nights ago.
Hey!
Give it all up, nobody gets hurt. It's only money.
So where do we go from here? We start with Trapman. They are not gonna okay anything major here.
What does that mean?
They just want you to talk to him.
Hey, what's going on?
Hey!
Talk to him. Shove him around a little. Don't hurt him too badly, because they don't want him hurt.
Just have a beer.
So yes, Killing Them Softly. In its very most basic sense, this is a movie about the retribution that a criminal organization wreaks after a couple of knuckleheads knock over a card game. Again, very basic, very simple. There's a lot more going on than that. Why don't we kick it off with Danny to give us his opinions on this film?
Oh, absolutely. I would love to offer up my opinion of Killing Them Softly. It is a very positive one. okay, going from there.
Have you ever seen Parks and Recreation?
Bits.
Okay, there's a character called Perd Hapley, who's like a morning talk show host. And he does shit like that all the time.
Yeah, I don't know why I did that.
I don't know either.
So yeah, I really like the movie. The one aspect, obviously, that has been dividing everyone is the political sort of commentary that's very blunt in one note and kind of appears throughout the film. But that's something that definitely didn't kill the movie for me. I think what I took away the most was how kind of original and interesting it is to have this very stylistic, intimate look at criminals that are kind of low-level people. And even you can make the argument that a lot of these characters are just dumb, like, basically. And I think that's something we don't get a lot, especially in genres like this, which are often sold by telling stories about, like, the higher-ups or the people that are rising, so that by the time the movie's halfway through, they're, you know, making millions of dollars and living these luxurious lifestyles. This is very different, and I really like that and appreciate that. I also think the cast is just sort of phenomenal. If you look at how lived in every performance is, from Ben Mendelsohn, who's just like sweating bullets, and it made me very uncomfortable.
Yeah, he like hurts to watch in this movie.
Yeah,
it's disgusting.
It is disgusting.
And he has his clothes too.
Yeah. He looks like he just like rolled in chicken grease before every single take.
Yeah.
It's like, this is I'm saying this in like a good way though.
Yeah. Brutal. Yeah. Scoot McNairy is just like a chameleon in everything. And I think one of the things that was interesting seeing it with an audience is that the movie really starts out with Scoot McNairy and Ben Mendelsohn, and it's hilarious. And I feel like the crowd was loving that stuff. And then Brad Pitt shows up and the movie sort of changes a little bit. But like I said, I was with it throughout, and I just think it's a very stylish and thrilling movie.
All right. And Nick, what about yourself?
I'm really in this film's camp, and I was eating something, so I had to.
Can we have just a little bit of professionalism here?
Nah.
Okay, wait, what are you eating?
I'm eating a chef's salad.
Okay,
that's actually professional.
Okay, yeah. Is that professional?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I guess if it was a hamburger, then that would just be beyond the pale. But a chef's salad is fine.
Let me continue. Restart.
As long as you're done eating.
Yeah. I'm really in this film's camp, and I've found myself liking it in different ways and seeing it about a month ago. I actually saw this movie purposefully, knowing the content. I saw it on election day, which is, as you can probably imagine, a really perfect choice. But the one remaining, so I've had time to germinate on it. And the one, is that the right term? Germinate? I don't know.
I think you meant ruminate.
Ruminate.
Which would allow your opinion to germinate.
Yes.
There we go.
I've been ruminating so I could germinate. And the one remaining element of what I've been reflecting, thankfully, is how much I tended to just enjoy myself as the film played, because I think the movie is a really good time. But other than that, I've been turning over the political machinations, and I've been trying to figure out if it actually works. And my mind wavers on that as time goes on. I'm going back and forth. But I always end up coming back to these hugely effective scenes of sort of a small-scale spectacle and this genuine emotion, too. Because everyone here does outstanding work. You have Scoot McNairy, who is, for the first 20, 30 minutes, is actually the movie's lead, and then Brad Pitt takes over. But you also have Brad Pitt here, who is so good, and I think he is basically playing death in the movie. He's wearing all black. He kind of appears when he needs to appear. He doesn't say much, and he sort of seems indestructible in the movie. But then you have the more human side, too. You have Ben Mendelsohn or James Gandolfini, who is so almost playing a more pathetic version of Tony Soprano, which was, as a big fan of The Sopranos, that was quite a lot of fun. But it all comes back to Dominic, I think, who is delivering. This is my favorite film of his, and that might not be saying much because I wasn't a huge fan of Chopper or Jesse James. But after seeing this movie, I really, really wanted to see what he was going to do next, and even better, it made me want to go back to those movies and try and reconsider them a bit.
All right. So it's my turn now. Killing Them Softly. I'm trying to think of the best way. This movie feels pretty minor to me, and I don't mean that as a knock.
No, I pretty much agree.
Okay, so I just want to get that out of the way, because I'm one of those people who saw Jesse James. You know, I think I even plugged it a couple weeks ago on this as one of my recently watched. And, you know, I went into this and I was expecting something big, but I got something small and intimate. And, you know, it looks like it could have been shot in like a weekend, which is fine. I don't have a problem with that. It was just, you know, an adjustment of my scope. And like we all said, the first 20 minutes is the Scoot McNairy show. And, yeah, I was really, really in favor of this movie at that point. And I was surprised because I saw this in a very, very crowded theater, which I'm sure is, we were talking last week about how they pushed this a lot during football. And I'm sure that this was a little bit of that out. And I was surprised that people actually seemed to be into it, especially after the jarring opening credits sequence.
Yeah, it's which pretty, first time I saw it, I thought the projection was almost messing up.
Is the someone remind me what's the opening credit sequence?
It begins very abruptly, and then he's like walking through the desolate, you know, abandoned factory, and there's the Barack Obama speech going on, and then all of a sudden it just cuts to black, and there's like this weird discordant tone as the just pure white titles come up.
Mm-hmm.
So I was watching that, and I liked it. I don't know, there's something like foreboding and awesome about it.
And then also totally. Behind him are billboards for...
That was good. And I just want to clarify, I meant awesome actually in the way that it inspires awe and not awesome in the Ninja Turtles way. I don't know why that's important to me. But yes, so I really liked this movie. I loved the dialogue. There was the crackling nature of everything. And then even when it shifted to the Brad Pitt, Richard Jenkins stuff, which is a lot of just them sitting in Jenkins' car talking about just all the different bullshit that you have to go through apparently to kill someone, which you wouldn't expect, because a lot of movies like this, it literally is just like someone knocked us over, let's go out and murder them. But there's so much like political, not even machinations, it's really just like squabbling and red tape, and it made it seem like a really shitty job to have. I mean, Gandolfini's character, I feel like it was interesting. Maybe they spent a little too much time with it. But in general, I kind of liked the movie, as long as I don't remember all the times that the characters were either in a room that had a TV on the news or were listening to the news in their car.
It gave me such a good laugh. There's a part where Ben Mendelsohn's Scoot McNairy meeting. This is actually probably the opening scene, actually.
Where they're like just in that like slab of concrete and it's like just them.
Yeah, and someone drives by listening to John McCain speak about the economy like it's Def Leppard.
Yeah.
Because it's so loud. And I was thinking to myself, who has ever listened to John McCain speak and put the volume up that loudly, unless they were a typical McCain voter and they were like 75 years old?
Yeah, like windows down, McCain blaring.
Yeah, blasting some fucking McCain.
You want to get this party started, you know, you flip on NPR, you blast that McCain out your windows and throw up a gang sign or something. I don't know. Like, there was a literal point where I wrote in my notes, no one in this world listens to Top 40 radio.
Yep.
Like, no.
It was almost like world breaking for me, because I've driven in a lot of cars with a lot of people. And outside of like my mother, I don't think anyone has ever listened to news or talk radio in their car with me in it. Even my father, who's not really a music fan, will tune it to, like, you know, the greatest hits of the 60s, 70s, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But in this world, even mobsters playing a goddamn card game are watching, like, CNN. And I don't know why, but that was really kind of bothering me. And especially because I wasn't entirely sure, except for a few hand-fisted crossovers, like, you know, the reason that they have to kind of sort out the situation with the card game is because money's not flowing anymore, because people have lost confidence in the card games because one of them got knocked over, so everyone assumes it's not safe, so their criminal economy has shut down, and so they have to and so they have to like build back the public confidence in the economy by murdering someone, anyone, just to make sure that people will go back to playing these games.
Oh my God.
You're really taking this hard, man.
I didn't notice this at all.
I know, right? I'm sorry to blow your mind here, but this is a very subtle through line in this film. Because every single scene has some person talking on the goddamn news about building confidence in the economy and taking drastic steps to getting the American economy back online. And at some point, I was just like, I fucking get it.
Yeah, that's actually... I remember I saw this at a screening, so I got like a thing of press notes. And Dominic had a quote where he's like...
Hey, I have those press notes too.
Yeah, and he's like, you know, when I read this book... it was so clear to me how this like economical situation reflected what was going on during 2008. And I just thought to myself, like, you can trust your audience to get that too. You don't necessarily have to impose these speeches. Not that I'm saying I dislike that stuff in the movie. I'm just saying, like, I think part of this movie was like, I don't know if he thought that would come through clear enough. That was maybe part of his decision. And I think it would have, probably. But yeah.
I mean, even if you just had, like, one speech or one scene, right? I mean, that would be fine with me. But again, mm-hmm. This was just one of those things where it felt a little bit too like there was no faith at all in the audience's ability to pick up on this.
But you could also imagine the dissenters being like, how can you show that for one scene and not, like, make it consistent? Or, you know what I mean?
Because... And I would respond to those dissenters, if they do exist, by saying that no one listens to the radio and the news in as much of a ubiquitous, universal way as apparently everyone in this city does. It just doesn't, like I said, it was world-breaking that no one... There's like one scene where I think the guy's getting picked up at the bus station, and Scoot McNairy's listening to some music. Like, that was it. That was the only scene I got where someone in a car...
A nice use of Johnny Cash. Although I think that was non-diegetic, wasn't it?
Was it? I got the impression that it began non-diegetic, but then became diegetic.
Yeah, maybe. It's been a little while, so I might have forgotten. But yeah, then he gets in the car with... I'm talking about Brad Pitt. He gets in the car with Richard Jenkins, and lo and behold...
They have to... Yeah, they have to show the entire scene of them driving under an overpass for some reason... to get away from the construction where they met, and that entire scene is, like, scored with news. And then there are literally just shots where the camera shifts to, like, a TV, and you get to watch the TV in a movie with a political person talking about the economy and politics. And
yeah, I want to jump in here and defend the movie's political slant a little bit, because I sort of like that the movie is so blatantly about what it's about. I like that the movie is so on the nose that it kind of forces you to just, not kind of, it absolutely forces you to look at it and consider it. And I do think that, yes, it could have been handled more graciously. But part of me thinks that this is such an ungracious subject that the only way to handle it is to just kind of pound it into your head.
I guess.
Personally. That's how I feel. And I think that it is used to great effect sometimes. You talk about, I mean, there's the sort of the centerpiece scene of the movie is the audio track is layered over with George W. Bush talking about the economy as these two guys are robbing the card game. And I thought that was very effective. It's not subtle, but it's effective.
It's not subtle. It is effective. But again, why on earth are those people watching that?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't make any sense, but but I still, I liked it. I liked that because it worked, and I don't really care how much I feel like I'm being pandered to if I enjoy it.
Yeah, but I mean, like I said, that one scene, because it was so effective and because it was layered over a different action that was taking place, that's fine. But like when you have to be in the car with these two guys for 2 minutes as they're driving somewhere else... And it seems like the sole reason that they're showing you this route that they take to go under an overpass is just so that they can have some dead air to fill with the radio. That's a little annoying.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I could see that specific scene as maybe being unnecessary.
A little too much.
Did you like this movie? I honestly can't tell.
Yeah, I know. I knew this was going to be a problem. I did. Like I said, the performances were really good. Every time Scoot McNairy was on the screen, you know, I sat up a little straighter. I pricked my ears up because I just loved him and his conversations, and Ben Mendelsohn, who plays Russell, I mean, he's a weird, fucked up creation that's just like you can't take your eyes off of him. And even the political wrangling just to get some people murdered was interesting to me. And there were a lot of shots that I really liked. For some reason, the camera mounted on the door of the car during a specific scene was good. The assassination of a particular character, since we're not in spoilers, I won't say
of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford.
God damn it. There's a scene that takes place entirely in slow motion. I wasn't 100%
so beautiful.
I wasn't 100% sold on the necessity of it being like that, but it was beautiful.
Oh, so it's like high art.
It is.
So beautiful.
It's great. And the best part is, and I guess right now I'm going to justify the scene to myself, it's giving this operatic undertone to what basically comes down to a bullshit PR-driven killing. And so I liked that. And then there was a scene where a character gets the shit beaten out of them, and the sound design was great, and the water dripping off these people in their leather jackets was, like, luminescent. So yeah, there's a lot to love in this movie, and I think that I'm going to be more fond of it, thinking about it, than I was watching it, because I'll be able to mentally edit out some of the more grotesque political moments in it. Not even that I give a shit about its politics, it's just, like, it really did kind of grate on me the way that it was shoehorned in at some point.
Yeah. Two words about the scenes you mentioned. One, the slow motion killing scene, I think what makes that scene important is that it's basically putting us inside the mindset of Brad Pitt's character, and you get an idea as to his internal processes as he's carrying out these sort of actions. So I think it is crucial in that sense. It allowed me to sort of understand the character more and what he means by killing somebody softly. So in addition to the fact that it's such a wonderful moment, I do think there is a purpose for it. Okay. Secondly, you speak of the beating scene where it's Ray Liotta who is beaten. And that scene is actually difficult to watch.
Yeah, that was tough. Mm-hmm.
And I never, ever have a problem with watching somebody get beaten up in a movie, but it's the sound design of it.
No, the sound design was, like, striking and terrifying. People in the theater were literally, like, flinching. Like, I could hear people behind me rocking back in their seats. Like, it was tough. And, you know, you kind of get to like Ray Liotta's character. Everybody likes Marky. That's a running theme in the movie. And it was hard to watch. So I liked it. Like I said, you know, I think let's get into spoilers to talk about some of the more plot driven elements and the final scene. I'd like to get everyone's opinion on. But I mean, like, if I had to break this down into a recommendation, I would say see it. So yeah,
same.
I think I like it.
Yeah, I would not only see it, but see it in the theater. Give it a little nudge.
Yeah. Definitely see it in the theater. I mean, I went to an 8:30 showing last night, and the theater was packed. Like, not a single seat was open. So, yeah, I don't know if you all saw it with the public or in your rarefied critic screenings, but it was pretty packed.
Interesting. All
right. So let's get into spoilers, guys. Yeah, the last scene. So Brad Pitt. There's a thing in this movie, a lot of talk about money and the economy, just in terms of how much you're going to get paid to kill someone, which is actually kind of awesome. And it's this weird scene where he realizes that he's only been paid $30,000 when the guy who he's replacing used to get $15 per person. So he's basically getting shortchanged. How much? I guess it would be $15,000. He basically did one killing for free.
Yeah.
And, you know, this
because
is all
of nudge, nudge, recession prices.
Exactly. And one of the reasons that this is kind of an underlined scene is this is happening literally on election night. Mm-hmm. So, Barack Obama is giving his acceptance speech, and Brad Pitt is commenting on it. And saying, like, you know, oh, this one community bullshit, blah, blah, blah. And then it closes with him saying, what is it? America's not a community. We're not one people. Like, we're a business. Fucking give me my money.
Yeah,
give me my fucking money.
Yeah,
and then the movie ends.
And I feel like there are things that could be excised easily, and that really don't add much to the overall picture. But here, I mean, that was about 160 minutes. This is like 100. No, this is 97, I think. So you really, I really felt the brevity of it, and that was one satisfying element. How it, you know, you have that scene, and then you end it with Barrett Strong singing "Money, That's What I Want," right?
Right.
It kind of sends you out on a good note. But also, I found that it was, again, not subtle, but it worked because it feels like something that this character would actually say in real life. And there's that authenticity to it, which I think is what sort of allows the movie to work in its more political moments, except for, again, when you have someone blasting the radio of Talk of the Economy, or these criminals are watching George W. Bush on TV, for example. So I think it is actually sort of a good encapsulation of the entire, of how I feel about the entire movie, actually.
Okay. What about you, Danny?
I think it's a pretty, pretty badass ending. I'm not going to lie. I kind of like the attitude of it where, you know, like Nick said, like they have all the plot covered and Dominic sitting down, he's like, okay, how should I end this thing? And he's just like, let's have Brad Pitt just rant at the camera and then end the movie. I think it's kind of cool. I also, it has one of my favorite moments in the movie where Brad Pitt goes to the bathroom and Richard Jenkins puts out his cigarette. Because earlier that, Brad Pitt had smoked in his car. And I like that. So yeah, I think it's just, I think it fits well within the movie in terms of, like, the whole movie has this sense of just anger about it. Like, it's so, it's just angry and upset at how this, at the state of things. And at the end, he kind of just comes out and says it one more time, and then it ends.
Okay. I guess.
I mean, I like got a rush from it, like I did from a lot of scenes in the movie. So
yeah.
I'm looking at it more on like just an immediate reactionary level. Like it just really kind of gave me this visceral like punch.
Yeah. I mean, I got a rush out of it too, but I think I was just kind of hung up on like, how does this fit in? Do I like the fact that it's just like, you know, he's actually watching this speech and like commenting on it in a way that the movie had been kind of commenting on it previously. And I was like, I don't want to say confused or flabbergasted. I was just like, I think I'd been so switched off by all the other political commentary the movie had done. And it was kind of weird to finally have someone pointing out the fact that the fucking news is on. And this is the only time it really seems appropriate, because it is election night. And even at the college bars I was frequenting back then, you know, the election was on. It was a big thing. You know, we all wanted to know what was happening. So it finally made sense. And he's talking about it. But it just seemed really weird that this man who just killed three different people, and he's now like making a comment on the state of America as to how he's been fucked over with his like hitman money.
I think it's one thing I just thought about right now is when he's on his way to the bar there, there's this slow motion shot of him and there's all these fireworks going off. And then he gets into the bar and it's pretty dead. Like there's maybe two other people besides him and Jenkins. So I think there's maybe an interesting track in the movie where it's like these presidential speeches are always playing when these guys are talking and like discussing their business, but to what extent are they still two completely opposite realms that are never really going to interact with one another? That's just a thought.
I guess so. I don't know. I'm still having trouble with that scene. I think I was just primed to have trouble with it because of all the other stuff in the movie. Again, it's a scene that I liked. I just feel like there's an aspect of it that kind of got turned off for me, just because of the way the rest of the movie played out with all the political stuff thrown in there. So yeah, I, you know, it's weird. Nick, you asked if I like the movie or not. I feel like I'm positive on it, but the things like that just give me pause. Cause I'm like, if that scene had come in alone, it would have been in a vacuum and it would have been really weird. But at the same time, I got way too much other stuff first. And so the scene felt like another obvious cap. I don't know. I'm not one of those people who likes to say how a director could have done something better. And luckily for me, I have no idea how it could have been done better in this case. So yeah, there's that. I don't know, guys. In general, though, I really feel like I have no idea how to feel about this film. It's very odd. I don't know what to do.
Someone I mean, it's pretty important how a movie like sends you out. So if you don't like the ending, I could see where that could kind of just throw your whole.
But the weird thing is that I kind of did. Like when he says, you know, America's not a community, it's a business. Give me my fucking money. Like I was like, hell yeah, Brad Pitt. Give him his fucking money. Like that was a really badass moment for that guy, who up until this point had just been kind of stewing over all the ridiculous, idiotic political bullshit that he had to go through just to kill three people. So I did. But at the same time, looking back on it, I'm just like, wasn't that a little bit too much? Wasn't that a little bit heavy-handed? But it's like the movie is at war with itself within my mind and memory. And I don't know what to do about that. But yeah, in general, positive. Go see it. I really liked it. It kind of sucks how much I grew to care about some of the characters who end up with their brains splattered all over.
Yeah, what did you think of Scoop McNairy's death?
I could see it coming. I was not happy about it, yeah. But you know, you can't let that guy live.
Mm. Yeah.
That's just the way of the game, man.
Did you also like when he kills the sort of the mid-level guy?
Oh, Squirrel.
Can't think of his name, unfortunately. But
is it the guy? The guy who like set it up, right?
No, Brad Pitt kills him with a shotgun.
Yeah, that's Squirrel,
the dry cleaner guy.
Yeah.
Yep.
Squirrel.
Great scene.
Yeah. People in the movie theater that I was in gasped from that because
it's a pretty brutal scene too.
Yeah, the back of his skull like explodes and his skin peels like a fucking orange. It's brutal. It's nuts. It's hard to take in and be ambivalent towards. Yeah.
Yeah. I kind of mentioned this earlier, but one of the things I liked most about the movie was how it really wanted to give you like an intense sort of depiction of what these people's professions are like. And I think it's moments like that where it takes 5 or 6 or 7 minutes to show one killing, or where it takes, you know, 10 or 12 minutes to show the poker heist, where you really get a sense of like how if you were trying to get by doing things like that day in, day out, like it would drag on you. You'd end up like James Gandolfini pretty much.
Yeah. And the absurdity of his story, the fact that he's going to get thrown in jail on a felony possession conviction for wanting to hunt geese.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy. Yeah, I mean, like I said, even James Gandolfini's storyline, which I felt like took up a lot of the movie to basically act as just another occasion for some good dialogue. Because if you look at this from a pure plot level, it's almost infuriating how many little side trips there are just to get things done. But when you look at it from another kind of story level, you kind of appreciate the amount of meticulous detail that goes into showing you how this works. And then just from an acting and dialogue level, it's also really good. But then when you look at it from the political subtext, you kind of hate how it mars 3 or 4 scenes by just being so over obvious. I don't know. I'm going to have to see this again, probably.
Do it.
Yeah, I don't know. But in general, like I said, if someone asked me, I'd tell them to definitely go see it. Because it's the things that work really well. And the things that don't, I've been able to kind of either gloss over or forget about, or, you know, justify their academic reason for being there, even if I don't embrace it emotionally. So I really hated the fact that Ray Liotta had to die. I felt really bad for his character. Like, that's one of the most senseless and just unnecessary and kind of depressing killings that I've seen in a movie in a long time.
At least he was killed softly.
He was killed softly. Well... One of my favorite parts is when Brad Pitt was talking about the unnecessary nature of beating him. And he just said, it's going to be unpleasant for me. It's going to be unpleasant for Marky. You know, no one's going to really like it. It's not going to tell us anything. But, you know, the guy's got to get beat. That's just how it goes. It was sad. It was depressing. But, yeah. I think I've said all that I can say about this film. And I've said a lot without really saying anything, so that says something. Anyone else have any final thoughts?
What's going on with Velvet Underground in movies this year? What's going on there? Because there's two covers. I talked about that when we reviewed Flight. But this is also kind of a branch. This is now the second movie this year where somebody does heroin to some of their music. And I feel like that might have been the most unsubtle moment in the entire movie for me.
That's true. I will, however, say that
doing it to the song titled Heroin about taking heroin,
yes,
mind you.
It's not subtle. I will, however, say that actor was one of the most convincing portrayals of a person on heroin that I've ever seen in a film.
Mm.
I think that was almost why that scene, I wanted Dominic to like stop doing that flash thing and just show Mendelsohn. Because he was so convincing in that scene. I almost got annoyed that it kept cutting away for those like flashes of light.
Yeah, as his like he's fading in and out. I appreciated that to a point. I think they could have done it like maybe twice to really put across this idea that he is, you know, fading in and out. Because if you've ever talked to someone who just did heroin, it is so aggravating. Because you really do have to continuously snap and like clap to get their fucking attention as you're
you've
just trying
this
to get
a lot.
Not recently,
but you've done this at all.
I have had to, I've lived with a guy, shall remain nameless. It really is like sitting in a chair, head lulling, and he's like kind of trying to be there, but not really. And you're just trying to be like, dude, what time is this thing we're going to? And he'll like, you'll have to repeat it 6 times. And so being in this movie where they have like the world kind of zooming out and him going to like his mental headspace and then having to zip back just to get some like very simple basic information. I mean, yeah, I was sitting there and I was just like, oh man, this guy gets it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
After we stop recording, I can explain this better. But yeah, as someone who's been there, I was in it with Scoot McNairy's character at that moment. It was aggravating and annoying in the best way possible. I love that kind of veracity in a film. Anyway. Okay. let's move on then into our look at the week ahead. We can give you fine folks at home some idea of what's coming out on DVD, Blu-ray, and in theaters that you should check out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So from Blu-ray.com, coming out December 4th, we have The Dark Knight Rises, Finding Nemo, released on Blu-ray. Brazil is coming to the Criterion Collection. Catch Me If You Can, Up. It looks like the Dark Knight Trilogy is coming to a box set with a
bare bones release, though.
Yeah. There's one that comes with a Batman cowl that's
broken.
Yeah. Purple Noon.
Broken cowl.
Purple Noon is coming to Criterion. Simpsons 15th season is coming out. It's funny how, like, every other DVD is a different iteration of The Dark Knight Rises. Beast of the Southern Wild, Existenz, VHS, The Odd Life of Timothy Green, some sort of Halo thing, which is weird. Suddenly, starring Frank Sinatra, Hope Springs, Santa Claus Conquers the Martians, Titanic, Blood and Steel, Hugh Jackman starring in Oklahoma. Oh snap, The Adventures of Mark Twain Collector's Edition is coming to Blu-ray.
Yeah.
As is Butter, Spy Kids 3D. There's a lot of stuff coming out. I think I'm done. Lady Antebellum in Concert and Ai Weiwei Never Sorry.
Okay, so Dark Knight Rises, still really like it, which is kind of weird because it's sort of in that weird backlash phase or something, which is always so stupid, but still really like that movie. Catch Me If You Can, late era Spielberg, kind of a new classic of his, I think. Great film, great time.
Perfect movie.
Yeah, it's great.
I love
Brazil is coming to Blu-ray from Criterion, and which is kind of a big deal because that DVD set is one of their most comprehensive releases ever. The fact that it's now in 1080p is pretty cool. Let's see. Beast of the Southern Wild, screw it. No, don't see it.
I was about to say, you were not.
It's bad.
I'm going to counteract that by saying definitely see it.
Yeah, no, don't see it and don't support it either.
Danny,
Hostel and Hostel Part 2 Blu-ray double feature.
Oh snap!
I actually really like the Hostel films, so I'm going to throw that out there. Past that, yeah, not much reaction to.
Not a fan of Existence.
I've never seen it.
Oh really?
Yeah, never seen it.
I should see it.
It's quite good. Yeah. I liked it a lot. So there's that. I really liked Beast of the Southern Wild, so I'm going to plug that against Nick's anti-plug. Dark Knight Rises, I'm still a huge fan of, so I want to see that. Up, obviously, is great. Catch Me If You Can, I agree, is pretty much a perfect film. Yeah, it's a big DVD week, guys. You got a lot of choices.
I would, I'd really urge people to check out Hope Springs, and that's not a joke, even though it looked really silly and stupid. Tommy Lee Jones he should be getting as much recognition for this performance as Lincoln, like, honestly. And, you know, after stuff like The Iron Lady, it's really kind of comforting to see Meryl Streep kind of just playing, like, an average person that doesn't have too much makeup and a weird voice.
All right. All right. Anyone see The Odd Life of Timothy Green?
No.
Okay. All right, we can move on then into what is coming out into theaters. We have Hyde Park on Hudson, which is the movie that has Bill Murray playing FDR. We then have Playing for Keeps, which has Gerard Butler as he's like a soccer player or something that's coaching his kids' Little League soccer team.
He's also trying to sleep with all the soccer moms.
Is he? Is that the thing?
Yeah, that's what it is. That's exactly what it is.
Okay. The sad part is that the director of this did The Pursuit of Happiness, The Last Kiss,
and
7 Pounds.
And?
Kiss Me Again.
7 Pounds.
I said 7 Pounds.
Ooh.
Yeah.
He also directed the pilot for
Evil. I feel like this isn't a big leap for him.
Yeah. No, I actually enjoyed 7 Pounds.
Oh, you did not just say that.
Nick, it's weird the movies that you and I agree on and then completely diverge on.
7 Pounds, I don't think there's a lot of divergence there.
Really?
Among people.
I don't know, I enjoyed it. I didn't think it was like great, but I kind of appreciated it. I thought that the ending was kind of hokey, but in general, like as a film, it was watchable and it was enjoyable.
I've never seen it, but I just...
Are you serious? All right, this conversation's over. Moving on, Deadfall is also coming out. That stars Eric Bana and Olivia Wilde and Charlie Hunnam, and as well as Sissy Spacek. That's about two siblings who do a casino heist. Lay the Favorite, I don't even know, guys. Bruce Willis, Vince Vaughn, Catherine Zeta-Jones... doing something. A Las Vegas cocktail waitress falls in with Dink, a sports gambler. Something about his wife Tulip. I don't know. I refuse to read this anymore. Finally, there's Cheerful Weather for a Wedding, which I've never heard of either.
Oh, I saw that at Tribeca.
Oh, actually. Was it good?
I liked it. It's good. It's fun. Nice little British period drama. Some romance. Very nice landscapes and houses. A lot of sort of that. Yeah, it's good.
Okay. all right. Deadfall, I should say, is directed by the guy who did The Counterfeiters, which won the Academy Award. So, I mean, that's possible that it could be good. It's coming to a theater near me, so I might see it. But yeah, other thoughts, guys? Hyde Park on Hudson, are we looking forward to that?
Nick is.
I said before we were recording how I grew up right in that area. I was born 5 minutes from FDR's house, and... I've been to FDR's house many, many times. And so, you know, I have like a connection to it. And I also am sort of interested in the history of King George's visit there, his first visit to, I believe that was actually the first royal visit to the United States.
Yes.
United States became its own country.
And we fed them hot dogs.
Yeah, they had hot dogs. That's right. I do kind of want to see it because I also want to see Bill Murray's FDR. So,
yeah, I'm torn about this. Some of the aspects of the trailer look good, but I don't know if it's just the way the trailer's cobbled together. It just doesn't. I don't know. It kind of seems I don't know. Anyone who's seen the trailer probably knows what I'm trying to articulate here and failing at.
Yeah, right? I have nothing better to offer.
All right, good. Yeah, so that's about it, unless someone wants to talk about Lay the Favorite. Okay, that's what I thought. So let's move on into our reviews, recommendations of something that we watched on our own this week. Nick, why don't we start with you?
So yeah, I couldn't really watch much this week because I had a kind of a lot of schoolwork. But during the week, I did watch for the first time Funny Games, the original one from 1997. I had seen Haneke's 2008 remake. That was actually the first film of his I saw. And I remember really not liking it at all. But because this original is the only film of his sans amour that I have not seen, I figured, well, watch it and see what happens. And I'm not sure why, but even though I did not like his remake, I ended up loving this movie. I think it is very effective, and the filmmaking in it is often breathtaking. It's so intense, but it's also kind of – it carries the self-reflexive quality, which sort of relieves some of that tension, I think. And that's part of why it is such a brilliant work. I don't know if anyone has any thoughts on that.
I've seen both.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the original first, and I loved it. And then I saw the remake, and they're so similar to me that they just kind of like – formed this amorphous tandem. So it really breaks down into, you know, if I feel like watching subtitles or if I feel like listening, and if I'm showing it to someone, whether I know that they'll be cool with subtitles, and if they're not, then I'll show them the American version. Is there an appreciable difference that you could see that made you prefer one or the one over the other?
I think it might have just been a matter of timing, because I saw the original Funny Games in 2008 when I wasn't as well versed in film, and I didn't really know what made films work as well. So perhaps if I go back and I watch the American version, I'll like it more. But the thing about the more recent one is that it's the reason Haneke remade it almost exactly is because this was his way of, you know, sort of pointing his finger at the American audience and saying, this is the kind of stuff you want because of trends in horror with things like Hostel or Saw. But that doesn't work for me personally because I don't want to see that. And so the message of it is kind of lost on someone like myself. I don't know if that – I think there are shades of it in this one, but I don't think it's in the same context. So because of that, it wasn't – that wasn't present. And also, I don't know, maybe something about there not being recognizable actors in this one made it more stressful.
Okay, I get that. Yeah. All right, Danny, what about yourself?
I watched High Art, which is the feature debut of Lisa Cholodanko. And I don't know, did you guys see The Kids Are All Right?
Yes, I did.
What'd you think of that?
I was really angry at everyone who wasn't Mark Ruffalo.
Yeah, no, I actually had the exact same opinion. I thought his role was fantastic, and I thought the female roles weren't written that well.
No, and I just felt bad because like, the guy was like dragged into this, and then everyone got really mad at him for it.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Okay, yeah, so we literally have the same opinion of that movie. Yeah.
Nick, did you
then
see
you would
this?
Probably really like High Art because the female roles in this, I think, are like written so much better. It stars Radha Mitchell as like a photography intern, and she starts getting involved with this older woman who, played by Ally Sheedy, who's like a used to be sort of a famous photographer, and now she's kind of gone into hiding, and she's like into drugs. And both of the roles are just very convincing, and you know, it tackles similar issues like lesbian relationships. And I just think it's a far better and more authentic movie. And I would recommend checking it out.
Huh. Nick, did you see The Kids Are All Right?
Yeah, it was okay.
All right. Did you have our same opinion about Mark Ruffalo?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Yeah, it was weird because I saw it and I was just like, am I supposed to hate everyone but him? I felt really bad. The guy was living his life. These people come into it. They assimilate him into their family. and he's just kind of like being buffeted by all their madness, and then they like kick him out like he's a bad guy. It was fucked up.
Did you not like them because they're lesbians?
Oh, Jesus. See, that's my other problem. I couldn't really like voice this at the time because I was just like, people are going to think that.
Mm-hmm.
But no, like I've seen it a couple times and I'm just like, each time I come to the same goddamn opinion. No, this is kind of an offshoot of this. Do you, any of you watch 30 Rock?
No, not really.
I watched like the first two or three seasons.
Jesus. Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's a point where Tina Fey's main character, she has like an ex-boyfriend who's like a typical New York Irish like dirtbag, and he crashes her house during St. Patrick's Day, even as she's living with her new boyfriend, and like him and the new boyfriend become friends, and he's like, "Hey man, check it out, there's a Les movie on TV," and later on you find out that the Les movie he was watching was The Kids Are All Right. Because he says something like, you know, hey, that Les movie was pretty awesome. It ended, you know, the kid's going to college and Mark Ruffalo's going to do his own thing.
Yeah, it's sad. Like, that guy was awesome.
I know. He was... I'm going to watch that again just because I want to feel that righteous anger. Anyway, that's all going to get cut out. So, yeah, my choice... I watched a lot of movies. I've had this weird kick going on where I've actually had time to watch movies. It's very strange. I'm not sure why it's happening. I watched Anna Karenina again, so I'll plug that because it's still out in theaters. Everyone should check it out. I actually had to see a showing that was 2 hours later than what I originally intended to see because the first two were sold out. So I don't know. I don't know if this movie's doing good business, but it's doing good business in this one theater in particular.
Oh, yay.
If we ever do a show on Anna Karenina, you can look forward to an epic showdown between Nick and I, because apparently I loved it. He was less than enthusiastic about it. And I'm sure that will also give us a chance to talk about Hannah, which we also have a similar dichotomy on. As for something that's out on DVD that you don't have to trek to a movie theater to see, I watched Match Point by Woody Allen, which Jonathan Rhys Davies is the main character, correct? Am I getting that wrong?
Or is it Myers?
It's Rhys Meyers, yeah.
Isn't Jonathan Rhys Davies Gimli from Lord of the Rings?
Yeah, yeah, he is. He's also the professor from Sliders.
Yeah, it'd be a very, very different movie.
That would be a much better movie, I think, honestly. Yeah, Jonathan Rhys Meyers. I knew I was going to do that, too. Anyway, yeah, Jonathan Rhys Meyers, Scarlett Johansson, Emily Mortimer, Matthew Good, who's a fantastic actor. Yeah, so it's a good film. It's about adultery and luck. Luck is a very massive theme in this film. And yeah, it's a different kind of Woody Allen film. It's a big break from form. He kind of followed it up in a similar style with Cassandra's Dream. He's a big fan about proper British people doing improper things, apparently. So, yeah. You all have seen this, right? Both of you?
Yeah, it's great.
Excellent. All right, so we have a consensus on Match Point. That's about it. I don't want to say too much about it because a lot of the fun is just watching how this madness unfolds and seeing where it goes. But it's definitely worth a look. And that'll bring us to the end of our discussion today. If you have any thoughts, comments, questions, you can send them to us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. Other than that, though, next week we will be talking about either The Silver Linings Playbook or possibly Anna Karenina. So, if you have an opinion on that, you should let us know, because we'd love to have some help deciding which to see, and we'd love to gauge popular opinion on what you'd like to hear about more. Until then, however, let us tell you where we can be found elsewhere online. Danny, why don't we start with you?
TheFilmStage.com, TheKingBulletin.com, and Twitter.com/TheKingBulletin.
And Nick?
FilmStage.com, Twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
And you can find me at thefilmstage.com as well as my personal blog, dearfilm.net. And you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/BrianJRowan. So ladies and gentlemen, thank you once again for joining us, and tune in next week.
You wouldn't really have sort of the feeling of, wait, this is what he made after, because how much...
Well, wait, hold on, wait. Something weird was happening. We really should talk about what kind of parent names their kids Scoot.
Yeah.
Good parents.
Good parents. Scoot's going to be the new John in 20 years after this guy blows up.